From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the Donald J. Trump Advanced Energy and Intelligence Campus near Amarillo plans to use nuclear power for the biggest data center ever, and how in 1910 the classic Western movie was born in San Antonio. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In Texas, we are used to the cycle of boom and bust, and right now there is a boom underway with AI data centers. The biggest and most ambitious AI project is called the Donald J. Trump Advanced Energy and Intelligence Campus. It's near Amarillo. The plan is for nuclear energy to power the largest data center ever. It's also known as Project Matador, and this is to win the war against China in developing super AI. Jason Plautz writes about it for Politico. His article is called Trump, Adams, AI, and the Texas Data Center Gusher.
What we're talking about is basically one of the largest gas power plants, nuclear power plants, and data centers, all combined into one massive construction project. For some comparisons here, the whole thing would use 11 gigawatts of power at its peak. That's more energy than 15 states use at their peak. And for Texas listeners, the entire ERCOT grid last summer peaked at more than 85 gigawatts. So this one facility would use more than 12% of that. What this would do is basically create power and create computing capacity for large tech companies, hyperscale companies to develop AI. We don't know what those companies are. We don't know what specifically they would be doing there, but that's the ultimate goal.
I hear the name Donald J. Trump Advanced Energy and Intelligence Campus. Is that the same thing as Project Matador?
That's the same thing as Project Matador, yes.
There's a lot of bundling with the pitch for Project Matador or this Trump Intelligence Campus with talking about America first, Texas loves to do great things. This is a war. This is, they call it a weapon in the war for intelligence. There's a lot of really sort of emotional momentum behind this. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I was really struck by that in the conversations that I've had. You know, Toby Neugebauer, who is the CEO of Fermi America, the way he described it to me was that, as you said, this is a war. This is a war with China. And he really sees the nuclear power as a center point of that. He told me a real superpower has nuclear submarines, nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, and nuclear-powered AI. This is a war, and I intend to do my part. That's what he told me. They have really positioned this as kind of the next step. This project would be built on a campus that sits next to and sort of around the Pantex nuclear weapons plant. And they really pitched this as the next stage in national defense, that this is a continuation of the work that the nuclear weapons assembly and disassembly plant has done. Positioning the U.S. to have power capacity and the computing capacity to build AI faster and better than China is doing. We're also seeing that kind of language from the White House. President Trump and some of the allies in the tech industry have really pushed building more data centers, building more computing power, building more electricity generation to be able to build AI at a faster rate than anybody else in the world and to have the U.S. really control this technology going forward.
The pitch man for this public-facing part of it is former Governor Rick Perry, former Secretary of Energy. What role does he have?
So he was involved in helping to get this set up. He has certainly been a public face. He is somebody who has tried to promote nuclear energy in the past, knows the Texas landscape very well, knows the energy landscape very well. The other face of this company is Toby Neugebauer. He's an oil and gas investor. Some listeners may know him as the son of former Congressman Randy Neugebauer. And he sort of used this knowledge of what was going on this site, the potential capacity of this site outside of Amarillo, and said, I think this is the best place on earth to build AI, to build the power that we're going to need to power AI, and sort of brought this whole thing together.
If you were going to do a TV show like Landman about this type of project, it would certainly make a great TV show. And then you were going to cast someone or draw up a character, a fictional character of a Texas billionaire who's behind this kind of a thing. You would come up with a character who is hard drinking, a hothead kind of a guy who would be behind it all. And that character, would that seem to be parallel with what we know of Neugebauer?
I think that is pretty much right. He talks big, he's acting big, and I think that's really key to this whole project, right? This is something that emerged in the early days of the Trump administration. We didn't hear about it until June of last year, but they are moving dirt. They are bringing in power equipment. The power world is really known for kind of moving at a slow pace, a very pokey pace. It takes a long time to do construction, especially for nuclear energy. And they have really used their swagger is really the best word for it. They're trying to move fast, they're trying to move big, and that is a huge pitch for this project.
I mean, they're already talking about by the end of this year, 2026, that they're going to be generating electricity based on the natural gas that they're going to be burning to turn turbines. Even that is an ambitious goal because it typically takes years to develop these types of facilities. And then to get to the nuclear power part of things, that takes multiple years to plan, to permit, to move forward. I know that President Trump has signed executive orders saying when it comes to AI, there are no rules, there are no regulations, you don't need permits, just go, go, go as fast as you can. But even under that circumstance, is this really going to be able to move as fast as possible, even in this pro-energy environment?
I think that's the number one question that everybody's going to be asking about this project. And that is the number one question that everybody brought up to me when I would ask about this. You talked about the nuclear power piece. They say that the first one of their reactors, they're looking at having four nuclear reactors on site. They say the first one could be producing power by 2032. That's only 6 years away. The last time a major company tried to build nuclear energy, it was Southern Company building the Vogtle plant in Georgia. It took almost twice as long as they'd anticipated. It was more than double the budget. So that's sort of the warning sign. And that was the only one that's been built in the last since the start of the millennium. So we're talking about they're trying to kind of double that capacity, do it on a really fast timeline. Now, what Neugebauer says is the whole industry has been sort of held back by its own problems, its own reticence to build quickly. They have brought in some executives who have worked abroad. They're trying to work with companies that haven't built in the US traditionally, but have shown success building reactors quickly in other countries. They say that that's their way forward. But again, time will tell, and the sort of the regulatory process, the just nuts and bolts of construction and bringing in this equipment. Everything can take a lot longer than you think.
Fermi America, that's the company co-founded by Neugebauer and Rick Perry behind all this. How much experience do they have in building nuclear power plants?
None. So they, as I said, Neugebauer and Perry themselves don't have experience building nuclear power. They have brought in folks who they say do have more experience. They say that they're leaning on experience, and that's what they're trying to do. But again, we're talking about these. Toby Neugebauer is an investor. Rick Perry is a politician. Certainly has a lot of experience in the energy world. But this is a little bit different than some of the growth that we're seeing elsewhere, where we have tech companies partnering with utilities or partnering with traditional power producers to build this kind of power. These are some investors who are just kind of coming in, looking at the trends, looking at the availability of land and potential power, and saying, this is an investment that I want to make.
They've done an IPO.
They did an IPO in the fall.
What's their value? What are you valued at?
At the time, it was valued at roughly $19 billion. The capitalization, the IPO itself raised 682 million. I should note that there has been a major dip in the stock. The IPO and a lot of their talk was based on bringing in a major tech company to partner with them by the end of 2025. They announced in December that actually that deal was not going to come through by the end of 25, and that led the stock to really drop.
Rick Perry's son is part of this as well. He was estimated to have made, at least in stock, $2.5 million.
$2.3 billion, I believe.
There are people who are making a lot of money over this project that has yet to generate one compute or one watt.
That's exactly right. And I think this really speaks to what's going on in the economy as we've seen it. I think a lot of listeners are probably familiar with this phrase, the Magnificent Seven, the Mag Seven, that have floated the stock market recently. We're seeing a lot of hype around AI, a lot of hype around this potential computing power. And that's extended to sort of supporting the utilities, to supporting the energy producing companies, to supporting the construction companies that work with that. But there's also a lot of warnings under the surface that maybe this is a bubble. Maybe some of that power isn't going to materialize. Maybe this AI stuff isn't going to pan out exactly the way that we think. And what happens to all that investment? What happens to all that economic activity right at the top of the stock market with these tech companies or these investors who are working in this space? If some of that doesn't materialize, and that's kind of a big question that's floating under the surface of all this AI build-out.
This is happening just outside of Amarillo. How is Amarillo reacting to this project and, and the water issue?
Yeah, the water issue has been a big one. To build any type of power plant takes a lot of water. To build a nuclear power plant, especially, takes a lot of water. And this is a region sitting right on the Ogallala Aquifer that does not have a lot of water to spare. What I found really interesting was talking to Trent Sizemore. He's the former mayor of Amarillo. He now works with Fermi America as a community lead. When he was the mayor, he locked up a 300-year supply of water for Amarillo. He said, it's so important, to just have this supply of water. He purchased some water rights from ranchers and other nearby folks. He has said, let's turn some of that water over to Fermi America. That's how important this is. I'm willing to sell some of this water that I helped secure to help Fermi America build. Fermi was able to reach a deal with Amarillo to sell a relatively small share of water supply to Fermi. Fermi agreed to pay well above market rate. That passed the city council, but there's still a lot of concern from the community. I talked to one woman, Kendra Kay, who is a tattoo artist. She grew up in the area. She's become a really vocal opponent of this project. And she said, this is just not worth it. We know that there is a potential risk of drought. We know that the water supply is short. Why are we turning over a valuable resource to a project that we don't know if it's going to pan out? We don't know how many jobs it's going to produce. And we don't know what the impact on the community is going to be. She says, this is not a worthwhile project if it's just going to help make some more rich people even richer.
They're also buying up the water rights from surrounding farmers, agriculture, and they're paying top dollar, way more than top dollar, to get those water rights. Is that going to impact the area economy, the agricultural economy?
I mean, well, that's it's basic economics, right? There's only so much water, and if they're taking some of the future rights, then that's not going to be available. Now, Fermi will say we are using much less water than the agricultural industry would use. We're asking for a very small percentage of what's available in the region. But again, this is a dwindling resource. And there are going to be a lot of questions, especially in a drought situation, about where that water is going and what the priorities of the region should be.
Yeah, but when we use water on farms, we get food. So that's something
well,
different. We need food.
Right. But they would say we're using water to help build the economy of the future, to help position the U.S. to win this war on artificial intelligence.
So what are the biggest milestones in the near term that we should be looking out for us to try to verify that this is not just a scam?
Sure. The number one thing is going to be watching for that that first tenant, the first buyer. Every morning I wake up and make some calls and look around to see who that's going to be. Have they inked that deal yet? Because that's going to really show whether this is hype or whether this is a project that is going to be used that has a real commitment. I would also be looking for, again, just the physical construction. Is that first gas turbine that they say is going to be producing power by the end of the year, is that materializing? Is that on site? Is that producing power? A lot is going to come out in the next year that's going to tell us whether this project is real or whether this is all hype.
Jason Plautz is a reporter for E&E News and Politico. His article is called Trump, Adams, AI, and the Texas Data Center Gusher. At the dawn of the American movie-making industry, before there was Hollywood, there was the Star Film Ranch in San Antonio. In 1910, a group of cinematic pioneers were determined to make the most authentic Westerns possible, and in the process, they created the framework of the art form known as the cowboy movie. Film historian Catherine Fuller Seeley is the co-author of the new book, The First Movie Studio in Texas.
It was one of the earliest attempts to break away from the dominance of New York-based filmmaking. The producer, French businessman, Gaston Méliès, got permission to release one 15-minute film a week, and he decided what the market needed were authentic Westerns, not shot in New Jersey or New York City, but in realistic settings. So he chose San Antonio as the company's home base and sent out a crew of about 20 actors and technicians. And they produced us over a year and a half. They produced a series of about 70 15-minute Westerns set in the contemporary Ranch West of 1910, 1911.
How would people experience these films?
Oh, that's a great question. It was the days of a boom of nickel theaters, a lot like today's boom in everybody watching YouTube videos and TikToks and things like that on their cell phones. The first movies were short, 15 minutes or shorter, and they were entrepreneurs opened little theaters in like closed shoe stores and markets and some in funeral parlors when they weren't busy having funerals. And these were wildly popular with American audiences because they were so inexpensive to go to. So there was a great boom in the Nickelodeon theaters, and the people who ran the theaters needed a lot of movies to show. So there were opportunities if you were able to make the movies to get to see them.
So not in a movie theater like we think of it now, they were projected on a wall, or were you looking
at? Oh, yes, they were projected on a wall. They were silent, but had usually live piano accompaniment. They weren't shown in silence. And the theaters operated at all hours of the day and night. So you could go on your way home from school or at your lunch break, or women would come home from their daily shopping and they'd be able to park their baby carriages outside. The shows were about an hour to 90 minutes long of these collection of short films. And so they were mixtures of comedies and dramas. And like I said, it was something new and inexpensive and novel. And so hooray that these Texas films in 1911 got to join the mix.
So why did they come to San Antonio of all places?
Well, it's all places. Well, so New York-based producer, French, a fellow who knew France much better than America, Gaston Méliès, decided to try and go the furthest west possible for the least amount of money to spend to send the crews out there. And San Antonio was the largest city between New Orleans and Los Angeles. So it actually was a major city, but set in the, you know, central Texas hill country with a wide variety of scenery. So he was able, he and his son rented a 20-acre ranch south of town down along the Mission Trail. And it afforded them a perfect, a small studio space. They shot every film outdoors, as simple as taking your cell phone camera out in the middle of the day and making movies. So it was, San Antonio was a logical destination. It had great scenery. It's a the historic missions and, you know, other scenery made it a fascinating place to be. And they had a wonderful time.
Did the fact that these films were they were shot in San Antonio, was that part of marketing? Did it add authenticity to the films when they were presented?
Absolutely. They marketed these films as real authentic Texas ranch westerns. And they hired, they brought, a, the performers were a combination of East Coast actors down on their luck and not able to get jobs on Broadway, as well as some local cowboys. Young men who worked on their family ranches around San Antonio, and some others who had been working for Wild West shows and rodeos, traveling out of Oklahoma, who you know were getting paid something every week to perform in these films.
Walk me through. Let's imagine that we are able to time travel and go to the set where they're shooting a Western, and what am I going to see? Walk me through that.
Well, oh, great. You're going to see the cameraman with a big, simple camera that didn't even have a through the lens viewfinder. They shot precisely at noon because he didn't want bad shadows to get in the way. They shot everything outdoors. When they had to set something on an interior set, they just built a small stage, a flat floor on the ground, and they would use bed sheets over the up in the sky to try and even out the sunlight. The film was very expensive film stock, so they would rehearse a couple times before shooting each scene. They shot each scene out of order, so they didn't shoot from the first scene of the movie to the end, but they emphasized action. So in every film, there was a wild chase on horseback or the young girl was being threatened by an evil desperado or the young woman had to get money to the bank before her family was ruined. So they would first spend the time shooting those action sequences, and each film had to be exactly 15 minutes long or 1,000 feet of film. So they would then fill in with other sort of scenes to set up that action or to have a quick satisfying conclusion. The actors, they you didn't have to have dialogue, so they made up dialogue to go along with this. And the actors had a great camaraderie. The female star, and this is really interesting because every film had a prominent role for a young woman. The female star was 17-year-old Edith Story, who, although she was raised in New York City, was a bit of a tomboy and a very excellent horsewoman. And she'd throw herself off cliffs and fall off horses. She'd do anything to make the film more exciting. The lead cowboy was actually, it turns out, the mysterious older brother of famous director John Ford. So this is how the Ford family got their start in movies back here in 1910 and 1911. And he was good. He could ride and swim, and he was a very good actor. But he also didn't mind playing villains or fools. And so, as I said, what I've learned was that the group, just like a group of I want to say teenagers, making movies in somebody's backyard and having a fine time while doing it, every story I found is that the group of actors and the cowboys got along famously and really enjoyed making these melodramas and these comedies, riding around on horses and playing jokes and tricks on each other.
They made the first Alamo movie?
Yes, that was their the highlight of their career over the during the 18 months that they were in Texas. They said our goal is going to be to make an epic of the fought, of the Battle of the Alamo, and that film was 15 minutes long. Unfortunately, we don't have that one today. We do have four other films that exist, but we have many stills and illustrations, photos from the set of the Alamo movie. And so they couldn't get access to the Alamo, which is in the middle of downtown, busy downtown. So they had an artist paint a backdrop that looked like the exterior of the Alamo. And they got young men, students from the Peacock Military Academy in San Antonio. So a little high school students whose uniforms looked a little like the Mexican Army. And so they put on their Alamo, made a 15-minute film.
What impact did these Star films, because they were shooting basically the very first authentic Western films. Westerns have become part of American Texas culture. What impact did this filmmaking and the storytelling have on the creation of the American Western?
Oh, well, that's a great question. Thank you. At the time, they were very popular. I've been able to do my co-author Frank Thompson and I have been able to do research into things like small town newspapers and film industry trade journals, and exhibitors and audiences loved these movies. They gave them high praise for the a beautiful Texas scenery, which was captured so well by the cinematographer, by the fabulous acting. By the great comedy and believable melodramas and wonderful action. But unfortunately, in years afterwards, the company sort of broke up by the end of 1911. Gaston Méliès went on to do other things. And so these films were forgotten. Gaston Méliès's brother was the film magician Georges Méliès, who you might remember from the movie Hugo about 10 years ago, 10, 15 years ago. And Georges didn't know about he had Georges had quit making films, and he didn't know about these films that his brother made. And so the films were completely forgotten in film history. So at the time, they were very influential, and the popularity of the Texas films made other filmmakers go, well, where else can we go? And this is when the rest of them discovered Southern California, that if you kept going west all the way out to the California coast, you could find even more scenery, tall mountains, the shore, deserts, and the ocean. And it was far away from the East Coast filmmakers who would tended to send gangsters out to break the cameras of their hated rivals. So Texas was this filmmaking center, but the next year everybody discovered California and moved out there. So these Texas Westerns are a marvelous link, a way to get away from shooting in Manhattan and when you couldn't shoot in the cold winters. Texas showed that it was possible to shoot on location in warm places in the winter. It gave other filmmakers sort of the interest to say, where else could we go? That ended up leading to everybody congregating out in California and then forming an entire separate industry out there. So a very important link in the chain and very prominent during the year they were produced.
Catherine Fuller Seely is the co-author with Frank Thompson of the new book, The First Movie Studio in Texas. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. You can find us wherever you get cool podcasts, and tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.